And it really hit me to my core, because that's when I realized people even have layers to how much they care at a human level. And I think that fed into my like experience of being a minority and understanding racism to a whole new level.
Welcome back, Melanin fam. It is your co-host, Natalia.
Renisha.
And we also have a special co-host.
Hello, hello. My name's Iman. It's lovely to be here.
Welcome.
I love that.
That was so sweet.
It was so natural.
I love it. So a little bit background about Iman, you know, and then we're going to do like a little improv question. So Iman is a legal caseworker and a social justice activist who has legal and human rights academic background. She has a passion for social justice, which has inspired her to be an active part of the third sector through various campaigning, researching, and community building roles. And let's be honest, I mean, the more you'll hear about her, the more you'll be like, oh my God, I need to keep my eye on Iman. This is person.
Oh my God, what a superwoman.
I mean, goals. Keep it humble, keep it humble. This episode is going to be slightly different than our other ones on the season. Iman is joining us as a co-host, and we're just going to talk through some topics. So, you know, I'm excited to get started. But just so the audience can kind of get a little vibe, I'm going to pose a question to everybody. All right, so top three favorite types of dishes to eat.
Oh. Hello. Is it because we were talking about food?
Yeah. That's 100% why.
Top three dishes?
Yes, 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 yes. So I'll go first. Just so you know, give you guys some time to think, you know.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mon and I are like,
we need an hour to discuss this.
I'm going to put y'all on pause.
That's what we edit later. Yeah, for me, I think I recently made chilaquiles. So, chilaquiles.
And why is that?
So that is, it's a Mexican dish, and you cut up some corn tortillas and you fry it fresh. Then you make your salsa, and you can either do red or green. And then normally it's some type of refried bean. You can use black beans or pinto beans. And then you just like mix it all together and put some cheese on top and a fried egg. Elevated.
Oh my God.
Elevated. I've been obsessed. Literally, I was talking to my friend back home, shout out to him. And I texted him, I was like, I'm craving chilaquiles. He's like, chilaquiles. I was like, yeah, chilaquiles. Like, back and forth. Then we just kept saying the word. I'm like, this is fun. Right. I was like, yes.
I need to try this.
I'll make it for you one day.
Please.
Okay. Hot luck on the way. I think the second one is any type of ice cream. Any type of ice cream.
We can sit in another dish?
You can make a dish, like a banana split.
Okay. We're good. Right. We're going that route. But I'm good. I don't know why I'd open it up. I was trying to think of some words correctly.
What's my third one? I think any type of... No, let me actually give y'all like a full-on dish. Honestly, pizza. I'm the type of girl. Any type, any day, any way, any topping.
Ooh, any topping?
No, maybe not.
She said, any topping?
She said, ooh. Immediately called me out. She said, hold on, pause. Maybe not every topping. So, like, not anchovies or anything. Gross. I do pineapple on pizza, though. I love a good pineapple on pizza.
I looked at her to see what... I had to look, because I said, how's she feeling about that?
Side eye was a girl.
She said, what?
I feel rejected. Like, hold on.
Get with it.
I need a second thing. My choices. No, I like it. It's good.
Okay. Right. At this point, you should have said top three foods and the dishes.
Because I was thinking meals.
Right. Thank you. Because she's over here talking about pizza and ice cream.
I'm like. And chilaquiles. Those are all meals.
And chilaquiles. Yes.
Chilaquiles.
Yeah. Chilaquiles. but ice cream and pizza, maybe that ain't no dish. Okay, but that helped me out a bit. So.
Sorry, I'm trying to help you out.
So listen, my top three at the current moment would be jollof rice.
Oof. Elite.
Really? Right.
Wait, which kind?
I know, right? Somebody just asked me that yesterday. was like, Nigeria or Ghana. And I was like, Nigerian, because he was there. No, I mean, but to be fair with you, I've only had Nigerians. I haven't had Ghana, so.
That is the most elite one, I have to say.
Is it? Okay, okay. Ooh. And that's okay, 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 okay.
I know. How dare you say that?
The comments are going to be wild.
I'm coming for you, Iman. Black
We're canceled. And then I had to look this up to, you know, to make sure. But a Korean dish, I would do bulgogi. Mm. We did that. Mm. What's that? One, two. And, you know, I guess, you know, American dish, meatloaf.
Really?
Okay. I've always been about that meatloaf.
Natalia, really?
Oh. Do you meatloaf?
I don't think I've ever had it.
It's basically just like you get some ground meat, right? And then you, if in my family, we're black, we put everything in that cabinet into this meat.
The one point
dish. I mean, mix it together. What holds it is like an egg and some breadcrumbs, and you just like shape it, the meat, into this like giant log.
Okay.
A log slash turd. Yes, she did. It's a log. Put that baby in the oven, cook it real well, and then, oh, okay. Controversial here. The best place that makes it back home is.
Don't do it.
What is it called?
I don't know. give me some hints.
We used to go to it all the time.
Oh, that's not a hint.
Country.
Country. Crackle Barrel.
Cracker Barrel. Thank you.
Oh,
Crackle
no.
Barrel. Okay.
Cracker.
To be fair, I've asked someone here in Scotland. I was like, is cracker the same way we've been used in America? And they were like, no, cracker means cracker. Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, cool.
But the thing is, I don't think people even call crackers here. Like, as in
the actual crackers, right?
My brain was like,
oh. Right, so.
But I have obviously heard of it just because of TV.
Right.
So that's where
it
comes. Yeah.
But Cracker Barrel is the restaurant. And yes, it is a problematic restaurant, but at the same time,
so bad.
Fire food.
If you're ever.
Fire.
If you ever want to go down a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories and like just awfulness, look up Cracker Barrel. It's so bad.
But the food is good.
The food is good. All that butter and lard, man.
Oh.
Can't go wrong with that. So those are my three dishes.
Okay.
Three dishes.
I've been inspired. So top three for me.
Okay.
First has to be cultural. So I think it would be. Chicken biryani.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
And yeah. Chicken biryani with potatoes as well. So we fry the potatoes too, and they're spiced, soft, but like a little bit crunchy from the outside. Second, I think it's a basic one, but loaded fries.
Ah, loaded fries.
Yes.
But what's loaded it loaded fries, with?
Oh.
Chicken.
Oh.
Cheese.
Oh.
Fried peppers. Like just pan fried peppers.
Okay.
Jalapenos.
Okay.
Gherkins. I think you call them pickles in America.
Yeah, we call them pickles. Yeah.
Okay, I'm intrigued with the gherkins on top. Okay.
Yes. Disturbed or intrigued?
A bit of both. Okay. I would try it.
And then a bunch of sauces. Any sauce you want.
Any sauce I want.
Okay.
Some sour cream. Oh, you could put some ranch on that.
I have three bottles in my...
Oh, three bottles, really?
Listen, we gotta stock up over here.
Someone's a fan.
Every time somebody comes from the States, go to the States, ranch.
You don't get it here.
No.
We can't, but it's like expensive.
I could get it on Amazon, but yeah, I'm paying an arm and a leg when I can have somebody else to do it.
Okay. Because I get like the supermarket brand ranch sauce. So I don't know what kind
here?
Of.
Here?
Yeah. Like Sainsbury's, Morrison's.
I don't think we're talking about the same ranch.
Probably not.
Nah, because no. I think you talk about like garlic and herb, and that ain't the same thing.
I think it's called ranch sauce, but it probably is like a different variation of what you have. Probably a lesser version of what you have.
I'm intrigued. You're gonna have to show me a picture of this later.
Because she got excited and
ain't no way I've been here for 3 years and I've never seen orange sauce either. I've been at every store.
I'll send you pictures. People will be disappointed probably.
Probably.
And the third one. So I think it has to be between plantain, fried plantain. With a bit of salt, just a bit.
Yeah.
And like maybe a bit of chili flakes on top as well. Yeah.
Oh.
And recently I've been cooking a lot of Palestinian dishes. And one that I love is just olive oil hummus with chili.
Oh.
And it is amazing. With chickpeas on top.
Oh.
Oof. It is amazing.
You got me.
Yeah.
You had me.
Yeah. It's simple but rich, you know?
It sounds so good.
Yeah.
And I've been craving plantains lately as well. Like... Every time I pass like a African shop, and I can get some plantains.
tostones, mm-hmm. just double fry crispiness.
Mm. It's so quick as well.
So quick. If you even like wait until they get super ripe and then you make them sweet with some cinnamon on top.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
I'm gonna try that next
cinnamon
time.
And sugar, like.
Oh.
I tried to make myself some hummus the other day, though. It didn't turn out right. It didn't.
That was a disappointment.
It was. Phase. I was trying to make some, you know, make my own hummus because I've been getting into hummus lately.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got my chickpeas.
Uh-huh.
Olive oil it up.
Did
put
you?
Some tahini in it.
Uh-huh.
But then it was too thick. And it had the same taste that I've tasted with other people.
Mm.
So I was like, what's wrong with mine?
Did you add water?
That's no. what I was saying.
Somebody said that too. Somebody said, did you add water? And I said, that makes sense. But at the same time, why would I add water?
Water or lime juice? Like lemon juice?
Because that
spritz it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I should have did that.
Lemon juice would have been good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, next time.
Now I'm hungry.
I can share my recipe with you. I'll do that.
That's basically family.
Right? We're on the same page now.
Oh, no.
Not that I know what kind of foods you like. I like this.
See? There you go. Mm,
I like
bonded.
It.
Over food.
The best
kind.
Bond.
The best kind.
Right. So, yeah, today's topic is going to be a good little chit-chat, I think. Mm. Let's go ahead and set the premise. So, ever since me and Ro moved to Scotland, one thing we kept running into consistently, and, I mean, everybody here that's listened to our podcast kind of already knows Scotland is white.
Scottish white.
Mm-hmm. Scottish white. There's a lot of diversity here. We just, it's not shown as much. But the thing we kept hearing is, especially from people in the UK. Oh, Americans, you always want to make things about race. It's not like that here. We're actually not like that. It's more like classism because, you know, we have poor white people too. And I'm thinking, what?
We struggle too.
Right.
Maybe in a different way. Get out my face.
What? How does one not, what?
Mm.
So keep that in your mind that everything is not about race. In the UK, they've done it, y'all. There is no such thing as racism. It's all classism. What? I'm sorry.
How?
How? Excuse me? So I think going into this episode, we're going to talk about each of our experiences here and then also kind of tune in a lot more to Mon's experience because you've been here and you've actually lived both in England and Scotland, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, tell our listeners a little bit about your experience. How does that make you feel?
Yeah. So I'll give a context of who I am in terms of my identity. And I see my identity in two lenses. So the first is like my given identity, right? So like my roots. And I see it as a tree, so like these are my things that I cannot change about myself.
Mm.
And a big part of that is my face. I'm an outward Muslim woman. Anyone who sees me sees my hijab first.
Yeah.
The next thing is that I am a first generation immigrant in the UK and that I'm Pakistani.
Mm.
And so when I think about this question, I think about it from that lens.
Mm.
And there's a lot of different ways that I can answer this question, or we can talk about this question, and I think we can go into depth in different areas.
Yeah.
But for me, the crux of it comes to this notion of British exceptionalism, and that is the notion of Britain is exceptional. Like, the failures that Britain has are so small that they can be overlooked by the many achievements that it has.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the premise is, right? So I actually got to research this notion in more depth in 2020 during COVID and during the Black Lives Matter movement being at its peak following the murder of George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working with this really amazing international NGO at the time called Restless Beings. Shout out to them.
Hey.
And I did a bit of research into what is British exceptionalism. Mm. And what premise does Britain have to think that we don't have that kind of problem here? So during 2020, the conversations that I was hearing and listening to, like at a high level through media, through like political conferences, was that the problem in America is grave, but that Britain will never be as bad.
Mm.
And at a lower level in individual conversations, I was hearing, you know, the USA is just terrible because they have guns and police brutality is at another level there. So then I thought, okay, let's research into this. And I was writing an article for Restless Beings at the time about this very thing. And I want to share a couple of things that I learned from that research.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing was obviously from the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, I was thinking, has there been, or what is the experience of a black man in the UK, right? And has there been such extreme brutalities to them over here? And what I learned was that when Derek Chauvin had a chokehold on George Floyd for 4 minutes, right? That same chokehold was used 4 times in 2017 on black men in that 1 year, which all resulted in their deaths. And that when Derek Chauvin was charged with second degree murder, in those 4 instances over here, none of the police officers were charged. And then I thought about, okay, what about the BLM protests that are going on? And you probably saw in the media as well how police presence was heightened at these protests. And it came to a level where politicians like Boris Johnson at the time was calling them thug protests. And for police presence to be extreme because it needs to protect civilians. But in the same year, you remember social distancing measures? There was illegal raves going on in the UK. And these illegal raves actually resulted in the rape of one British girl and the death of one man, which were overlooked. Nothing was ever said about them. And, you know, that makes you realize that there was no condemnation against these social distancing violations for what the white majority was ensuing. So after that research, I then went into individual cases and I learned about this woman called Belly Majinga. And some people might have heard about her. So during 2020, she was a rail worker working in London, and she was a black woman who was spat on by someone else. She then got COVID and died as a result. There was no criminal investigation into her death because apparently there was not enough facts.
Wait, how? What? Because this person, their DNA is spat onto this woman, and yet there's still no evidence or no case.
They stated that there was no correlation between her getting COVID and her being spat on.
That's wild.
Right?
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense to me.
And that's when I started seeing, obviously, we all know this. We all know this is like systemic racism that's rooted in the legal and criminal system. But when you see it on individual levels, they're like really painful reminders, right? And the last example that I want to share is of a 12-year-old Muslim refugee from Somalia called Shukri Abdi. And she was pushed into a river by 2 school students. And she was found dead in that river a couple hours later. The police called it a tragic incident, didn't look into it. So at the time, there are now inquests that are going ahead for her death. At the time, there was nothing. And the craziest part is that these 2 kids, during an inquest, one of the kids said, I jokingly said to Shukri that I'm going to kill you if you don't go into the river. Yeah, imagine a school student saying that, probably around the same age as her.
Right.
And there was evidence that Shukri's mom had complained to the school beforehand that my daughter is being bullied. Can you please do something? And they ignored her point blank.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, these are reminders of how Britain is rooted on this fact of suppressing minorities, calling for justice. But being so silent when there are white majorities causing and ensuing such violent hatred. And like we all know this, but at a systemic level, and when Britain has like the audacity to compare itself to America and say that its racism is not as bad or it's just not there, it's rooted in classism. These examples like hold really strong to the fact that Britain is racist. But Britain is very good at hiding it. And I think what that made me think of when I was thinking of this question is how Britain has been so good at hiding its history, especially colonial history. And when I think of the British Empire, right, and I think of it from a perspective of what have I learned about it in the British educational system? Nothing. I have learned about the slave trade and how Britain had like had a play in stopping the slave trade, but not about how Britain ensued that slave trade. You know, I learned about the composition of slaves and ships and how they were brought here. I didn't learn about why they were brought here or who brought them here, for what reason, or their treatment, right? So, you know, I'm embarrassed to say this, but like I didn't learn about British Empire in its entirety and reality until my 20s. And like I actually had like wanted to learn about it independently. And that's when I read this book called Empireland, and I recommend this to anyone, because if you care about British history or not, like just read it, because this I think is so necessary for us to know as people living in Britain what Britain's history is. And I'll give you a couple examples from that book. Like it was crazy how hardwired the British Empire is in our lives today. So for example, social reform in Britain, things like free school meals were brought about by the British government during empire rule, because the government did not want the like urbanized working class to be dangerously unhealthy so that they cannot maintain the British Empire. Yeah, against countries like America, Japan and Germany at the time. Similarly, British institutions like... do you guys have brownies and scouts and like girl guides?
Girl scouts.
So that was introduced in Britain during empire. So scouts, for example, was introduced so that boys could be taught how to be colonists. Girl guides was introduced so that girls could learn how to support men and build empire. And when you think about that, like I was part of girl guides when I was young, and I'm thinking about that, like what I did in girl guides was literally make cookies and
be that perfect housewife,
literally.
Yeah.
And I think the way the seeds were planted and how it's continued till now, like it's still going on now, you know. Kids go to these things and they just think, oh, it's just about like, I don't know, building a good personality or like being well-rounded. But who knew?
I knew. And I think like you said so many different things, and I have like a list in my head. I think the first thing is, again, like you were saying, Britain's so good at hiding their kind of their history. And I remember like me and Renisha, when we were planning to move to Scotland, we didn't do a whole lot of research, but we did some. And I remember the only things I could find was just how great Scotland had like not introduced any slaves on the land, and how like there were only like free black people in Scotland, and like there was little to do with like the slave trade and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking, wait, I get here and you have Jamaica Street, Merchant City, and like all of these things are completely labeled based off the slave trade. And like now being here and learning all these things, and I'm just kind of like, yo, how is it that this doesn't make it, one, how does this not make it to the internet? Because I'm thinking everything's on the internet. But then two, like, how are you so good at hiding and being blatantly, like, blind to the buildings around you, to everything around you? Like, you were talking about Goma, right? And that whole building was a slave trader's house, which I didn't know. And I recently found out, like, a month ago. And I was like, what? Like, that's ridiculous to me. But then like, the other thing you said is that even in school, so two things, even like in your schooling, you had to take that initiative to learn more about it. But then as well, back to the example that you gave of the young girl being pushed into the river, and the parents had already complained to the school. I was recently talking to somebody, and they have a nephew that's mixed, and they were bullying the mixed kid. He was the only mixed kid in the school. They were bullying him. And the mom had to end up calling the school, and then they were going to make a show out of this kid to show that you can't treat people that way. And they were going to use this example to show to other kids, like, oh, we don't do that. That's like racist or whatever. And this kid was like, I don't want this. He's like, no, let's not. That's not what I mean. And so I'm curious, like, you being the Muslim woman you are, growing up in England or even in Scotland, like, did you experience that?
So when I was growing up in England, I moved to England when I was 3 years old with my family and lived in a little county called West Yorkshire. which was white majority.
Yeah. Okay.
Countryside white majority. And lived there until I was 15 or 16. And at the time, I didn't wear hijab. And without my hijab, I am ethnically ambiguous. Mm. So people cannot tell that I am from Pakistan, I'm South Asian, or that I'm Muslim. Mm. And, you know, growing up as an immigrant who did not have much of a Muslim community in England, or the ones that I did, very small and very disconnected from, like, my school system and my friends. Mm-hmm. I had a real hard time, like, accepting that I was these identities. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to, because I just wanted to fit in. Mm-hmm. So at school, when people would, like, there was, I didn't experience, you know, that kind of racism or Islamophobia myself directly, but my friends would make fun of, like, ISIS all the time. They would make 9/11 jokes, and it was a norm. And the worst part is that, like, other Muslims would be making fun of it too, because, like, you don't want to call them out on it. Like, when I'm a 13-year-old girl, mm-hmm. I don't want to be calling out a bunch, like, a group of 6 white girls that are making fun of this, because they're gonna come at me.
Yeah.
And I just want to fit in.
Yeah, you just want to get through.
Yeah.
Right? And it wasn't like, you know, they were ever targeting at me. It would be my friends that are making these jokes, and I would laugh along with them. Mm-hmm. And that was the worst part of it, that, like,
kind of feel a bit guilty.
Yeah. Because that's my community that I'm, that I'm, like, hindering, you know, mm-hmm. that I'm limiting. And I'm also limiting myself as well. But as a kid, I had no idea what I was doing. And as a kid, all I wanted to do was, like, them not to know that I speak Urdu at home, them not to know that my mom wears hijab or my dad has a beard. Like, I didn't want to associate myself with something that was different to them. Mm. And I don't know if that answers your question, but, like, I think that's part of the experience of both being an immigrant, but also just being someone who cannot connect to, like, British values, whatever they are, or just white people in general, because I will never know their culture. And it only took, like, when I reached a level of maturity, but also when I found my own community and found that strength from them, that I was able to, like, start wearing hijab and start celebrating this part of me. Mm-hmm. And as a 12-year-old kid, I just didn't have that support system. And so it was easier to be part of that than to be, like, othered, you know?
I think now it's, like, you say that, and it makes me think back when I was in high school, I did exactly the same of just, like, I'm just trying to get through school, trying to get through life. And once I'm done and graduated, I can just, I don't have to be around these people ever again. But then I do think back at all the things that was, like, said or done around me, and how I would just, like, be okay with it and not be the person to speak up. And it's not like I can fault myself, right? Because during that time we weren't as loud as the society now are, right? But yeah, I do, like, kind of give about myself a bit of a cringe looking back of all the things that we just let go.
Yeah.
And not even with just, like, high school students, right? Sometimes with our family members. Because again, we live with these people. And so, and their influence and the way they live every day and their way of talking about certain individuals, I mean, again, I'm better at it. I'll be like, mom or grandma or so-and-so, that's not how you say it, whatever. But a lot of times it's just like, oh, well, I heard my mom or I heard my dad say this, and then I go out and say it out to the world. And of course the streets are going to teach you. Streets are always going to teach you. But it's just like, again, do you think back and faulting myself for that? Or again, is this one of those growths where we're out of the house and we independently learn these things? And I think that's so important. And I think, hopefully, you know, everyone has that mindset at some point in their lives, but it's not going to be all the same age of when we do that, right?
Yeah.
And it's weird.
Yeah. I think, like, as well, like, you were talking back, both of you were talking about your high school experience. And the both times you were talking, I was just like, damn, I try not to go that far back in my head.
It's really traumatic. Like,
because I start
to erase it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, damn. So, like, I remember middle school, high school, and the area that we were at, it was always groups of, like, white people and groups of black people.
Yeah.
And there was rarely any Latinos around. And the Latinos, maybe, like, 2. Mm-hmm. And we knew each other, but we all came from, like, different areas, so we didn't hang out much. Like, we saw each other and we would be like, cool, but, like, it wasn't like there was no community there. And I, thinking back on it, like, yeah, I remember, and this is partially from my mom as well, because, you know, people from LA, you know, they're snobby, we know this, but like, moving to the South, and then there's certain things, right? So like, you can always tell, I used to get bullied so much about the smell of my house. Then you'd be like, oh, you smell real Mexican, or you smell like a beaner, or you smell like this. And I was just like, in my head, I was just like, oh, I don't want to smell like this. Like, it was one of those things where it's like, I never thought about those kind of how that would impact my own image. Mm-hmm. And then I get to being older and I'm introduced to like a range of different cultures. And I feel like we always get picked for those kind of things. Yeah. Like, and to me, I'm like, why are we teaching kids that this is okay to keep doing and bullying? But at the same time, I'm like, but I was that kid as well. And then I internalized that. Mm. And I would actually, like, I would separate myself from sometimes, because there's a certain type of people that were Latins that I'd be like, I don't want to hang out with them, though, because now I want to fit in with this crowd, like you were saying. And it's just detrimental. And like, now I think back on it and I'm like, my two best friends are both people of color and completely different than what I was trying to fit into. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get that until like later in high school. Yeah, it's just, it's crazy to think that like, there's that systemic issue, right? Because it's not something that you just undo when you're an adult. That's when we become aware of the things. Mm-hmm. But they start so young, way so young. Yeah. And it's crazy to me to think that, like, it's not crazy to me to think, like, because now that I'm older, I'm like, this makes sense. Mm-hmm. But like you were saying about Britain and their impact on the world, these kind of experiences transcend borders. So it's like, no matter where you're at, if you're a person of color, you would probably resonate with one of our stories. And there's that common theme again of underlying racism and like systemic issues that are meaning to like make us feel less, make us deem ourselves to be less, to try to fit into whiteness, to try to fit in and bridge ourselves closer to that end of the spectrum, rather than where we come from or where we naturally are, and owning that. But we don't get that until we're so much older, which I think always just kind of like breaks me a little bit.
I feel like we don't get that till we're so much older, but also as well having the ability to experience in different cultural settings, right? I think your environment is very important, because again, I feel like I wouldn't have the experience that I have now here in Scotland if I still was in America, right? I'll still be only either reading about it or trying to educate myself to the best of my ability through like internet and stuff, right? But like actually living within that environment and speaking to the locals, both Scottish and British, Asian British, Black British, all of that, right? And hearing their stories is so important, because a lot of the time speaking to individuals, people of color in the UK in general, right, I always ask them the question. I was like, well, how was your experience? Do you ever experience racism? And like, to be fair, their answers all do vary. They do. And it's like, some of them are like, yeah, or no, I was in this part of the area. And I understand it also depends on like your social class and stuff like that. But I think it's very important, again, to speak to those individual experience, because I just learned so much. And I'm always in awe when I hear everyone's story, right?
And I think what struck me with what both of you said there is, the first is, you know, the things that we were made fun of when we were kids is now what white people celebrate.
Like, can we talk about that?
And it is so disrespectful. And you know, I don't want them to claim my culture. I don't want you making biryani in your kitchen. Like, I want, like, you can celebrate it, fine, but don't also be ignorant to the impacts of your racism upon my people and my culture, because it's so layered that their ignorance is like limited. So like, they will be aware of, you know, your culture in all its beauty and all of its richness, but they won't be aware of what they did to your culture and your people. And they don't want to talk about that because they are fine in their ignorance. Like, it is willful ignorance to the core, and it's so triggering.
It's so triggering. Me and Ro have this conversation so much, because I feel like it's a trend for like Mexican culture, especially in the US. Like, there's Cinco de Mayo, right? And like, that has nothing to do with Mexican culture, really. Mm-hmm. Like, people celebrate as, like, Mexican independence. It's like, it's not even that. Like, you don't even know what you're celebrating, but you're going to put on a sombrero, go eat some chips and, like, a margarita and call it a day. But, like, and I think as well, another thing of what you're saying is, like, if you are going to appreciate that culture, support the migrants that move here.
Yeah.
So if you really, truly appreciate that culture and think it's beautiful, support the people that that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
When they try to move here and they have their shops or they have, like, their restaurants, or even if they have local community groups, take part in that. Become an ally of that. Don't just, like, oh, because, you know, I wanted this food, I'm going to order this HelloFresh box and make it that way. Because it's, like, there's so much exploitation that has in it in itself. Support, if you want to come out with us.
Literally, come out fully.
Come out fully.
Right.
So we talked a lot about childhood growing up, but I kind of want to move us forward to now as well. And when we talk about racism or Islamophobia, I'm always curious to hear how that impacts your life now, and if you do still experience that, because I think we're in a quite interesting situation with the war in Gaza, and you're seeing it pop up a lot more here as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., it's disappointing, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But I think especially in Britain, because I feel like this either heightens something and it maybe, like, shows more of what this idea of racism doesn't exist, but really it does. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious, Iman, like, if you experience this today and kind of what your thoughts in general are when this ties into, you know, your area that you're around.
Oof. Sorry. That's a big question.
Okay, so I think I can start with unpacking what it is like now. So I think my experience is really impacted by how strongly I feel with my faith. Like, my faith is the core of what I do, right? And that has really informed my social justice passions as well. And I think the previous, current, ongoing genocide in Palestine really brought to light the strength of my faith in a community, because all I can do, or all I could do in the 4 months that have passed with the war, genocide in Gaza, is rely on my community.
Mm.
And, like, the way that we've come together to advocate for and support for the Palestinians consistently is, like, unparalleled. I've not seen that in the Muslim community or the Muslim, like, world at large in so long. And, you know, it's, like, one of the only silver linings to come out of this. Mm. But on an individual level, oh my God, I feel cheated. Mm. Like, it is a full betrayal. And I'm talking in the sense of, you know, I didn't have any expectations of the British government to begin with. Like, when I grew consciousness, that's when I knew I cannot rely on them. And they are snakes. Like, self-interest is at their core, and that's it. But I really, like, relied on the community at large. And I'm talking about, like, my Scottish community or British community or my, like, non-Muslim, non-Arab, white friends even.
Mm-hmm.
To think of this as a human rights issue, right? Or just a human issue.
Mm-hmm.
But the level of, like, ignorance, or just the level of, like, complete, I don't even know the word for it, but just did not care, that I experienced at an individual and communal level was honestly shocking. And this is, like, from people that have a really, like, they work in the sector, you know, they have experience of working with vulnerable people, like asylum seekers and refugees, that are from countries that have endured war and persecution, but they just treat that as professional. It's not going to be personal to them.
Yeah.
And it really hit me to my core, because that's when I realized people even have layers to how much they care at a human level.
Yeah.
And I think that fed into my, like, experience of being a minority and understanding racism to a whole new level. When I would see, like, the ingenuine sympathy that white people would have, or just the complete disregard they would have.
Mm-hmm.
And that also came from, like, the hatred, right? Like, the bigotry that the genocide has incited in like fascist groups, especially in the UK, is unparalleled. And the way that the British government is supporting them, the British government themselves being allies to a Zionist regime, like, you know, that should, like, that's a signal in and of itself that they're not going to be allies to anything else.
Yeah.
But that they're going to empower and platform the voices that are supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's shocking, you know, like, it's shocking to see. I don't have any faith in political parties, like even the Labour Party, but Keir Starmer being a human rights lawyer, I thought meant something, you know, and I thought that the Labour Party represented something that was distinct from other parties,
mm-hmm.
especially with the history of politicians that we've seen in the Labour Party. But I don't know if you call it naivety or just a level of hope,
mm-hmm.
But even seeing politicians and high level officials like him, not that I have any hope in him, but them also siding with Israel,
mm-hmm.
like, I don't know. I don't know where to call it. Just like, I just lost hope in any systemic level of support for Palestinians, but also, you know, it shows you as a ripple effect of how much they care for other minorities and races. And like, it's systemic to the core. And this is honestly, like, this is imperialism at its core as well, 100%. Right? Like, this is just what empire is rooted on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're continuing at the facade of, we are what, protecting like a minority of people whilst killing 2.4 million people, is it?
And we're okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think everything you're saying echoing it. And then as well, it also made me lose faith in, like, international, like, the, like, I mean, the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, this just the amounts that these systems are supposed to be set up in place for the very reason that it comes up today,
mm-hmm.
for them to step in and do something compared to them not doing a World War II, but then using the same excuse and being scared. I think mm-hmm. that's really shit, and I think that 100% made me rethink my own personal goals,
because
you do lose faith in these systems when it's, you just see them kind of continuing that same imperialist thought, and it, and also how difficult it is for them to be able to save people and to make that change in that area, and how easy it is for major players like the US to do one vote, one veto, and now everything is done.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that South Africa had to stand up and say, like, no, this is not okay, we're taking this to court. And even then, still going through the process and nothing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is continuing on. Like, it's just, I feel like there should be way more outrage than there is.
Yeah.
But it also 100% shows, if you were to take a map and redistribute it, like, how the power is held in the world globally, would still show exactly how that colonialism works. Yeah. Will still show that those major players that can prevent any humanitarian action to happen can call it and call it done. Mm. And I think that as well is super disheartening.
Mm.
And I don't think I could ever feel fully what you feel, because there isn't as much of a personal connection. Because I know I'm not Muslim. I am learning now what some of that means.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, like, growing up in the States, we were very much taught, again, to have that Islamophobia, to almost ostracize the people around you because they are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't think about it, but you also don't have a lot of communication with those communities,
yeah.
because America's so big, but you don't, it's not like here. I feel like here I'm exposed to a lot more. Here I'm able to learn about it, and here I'm like, oh, thank God I'm breaking down, like, things I never really acted on but were always fed to me. And it's just, yeah, I can 100% see how the UK government, every decision they're making is just 100% fueling that fascism. And it almost does make you lose hope and like the country itself, and as well, like, coupled with their migration stuff, as well, coupled with all the other hate that they're posing against people of color, there really seems to be this big push to marginalize people as far as they can, mm-hmm. or to even try to make this island all white again, yes. in the fastest way possible. Mm-hmm. And that's just concerning.
That's very concerning. Mm. Y'all about to sink too. Y'all on island. Mm. Y'all don't know y'all about to sink. So you need all the people.
You need all the people.
And those people are people of color, because we're the ones working the hardest and keeping this afloat. I don't know why you're trying to get rid of me. Because you're going to ask for me when you sink it and talk about help. No. I'm going to look at you from my high tech boat.
How much
talk
you about.
You should have had me when you had me.
I mean. Really?
I think they're a bit too comfortable. Mm-hmm. They're just too high and mighty for themselves. Mm-hmm. And what I've realized here is people don't care, like you said, because it's not happening to them as well. And I think that's so sad for some people to start caring when it starts happening to them. Mm-hmm. I definitely saw that, you know, during COVID, where people were like, oh, I'm not getting COVID, or it's not affecting anyone around me, so why should I care?
Yeah.
But you're not the only person on this freaking planet. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't think that way. And that's something I really, truly was like, that's mad to have that thought process. But at the same time, when you're in a comfortable position for a long time.
It's a privilege for me.
Yeah. 100%. How else are you supposed to think? Yeah.
Like, and then they always go, I don't have privilege. What do you mean? Mm. And I'm thinking, bro, what? Mm. What are you worried about?
That's a problem you said that, sir.
Right.
That's a problem.
Don't even come at me like that, because now I'm going to question you until you say everything that you're thinking, and all the problematic shit comes out.
Sometimes I really think they do know they have privilege. They just say that to people of color so we then can react and tell them all the things that they are privileged about. And, you know, we're like, oh, I just wanted to rile you up. Because that's exactly, that's how I'm thinking at this point.
They do that.
That's exactly how I'm thinking.
All the time. Because
ain't no way you're about to tell me you don't have privilege.
But that's the thing. I think it's been normalized to such an extent that they don't see it anymore. And like you were saying, they don't know our experiences, and they don't need to ask, because what's it going to do with them? You know, they can't relate, and they don't want to help. So they're in their little bubble, and that's all okay with them.
I like that you said that, and they don't want to help.
Yeah,
because that's it.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
100%. There's so many times I've had conversations with people, and I'll be like, oh, it's your white privilege or whatever. And they're like, there's no such thing as white privilege, because there's poor white people. Mm. I'm like, okay, you're highlighting a systemic issue. Cool. Let's dive deep into that. Mm. And then they can't hang anymore. And then it's all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, maybe you're being racist against white people.
Not the reverse racism.
Not the reverse racism. You know what? It's so funny you say that. In a sense, I was like talking to this person, and obviously a white male. And then I was just explaining to this person, I was like, I felt there was a bit of discrimination towards me. I was just telling them the situation, how I felt. You know, this person was like scanning everybody else's card, okay, but when I came to mine, I got the look, and I got like some extra words that everybody else didn't get. I'm thinking to myself, I have the same card like everybody else. Why am I getting stopped and questioned like I have, you know, murdered someone? Mm. And he was like, well, maybe he was just trying. It's like his answer was like, well, maybe he was just doing his job and da-da-da. What the?
Racial profiling?
Right! Is that his job?
Like, excuse, like, now we no longer talk, because if you're not going to have my back, if you're not going to be an ally, then I already know you're a problem, okay? You'll be the first person to hang me dry if something mad happens. Mm. And I don't like that. It's so scary. It's so scary. And just, again, that was only one example, but I feel like I've had another example in the same of like explaining to someone how I felt as a black woman discriminative towards, and there's an excuse for that person's action.
Yeah.
And it's like, when do my like feelings or my actions get validated? Mm. It's like, well, then it starts to look, damn, maybe what I was overreacting, or maybe that is the American in me. But I should really stop that, because again, no.
Gaslighting, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, ugh.
And I feel like that's how people here are. Like, I feel like in the U.S., if they don't like you, you know.
Yeah.
They'll tell you.
Yeah.
But I feel like here in the U.K., they have this, like, fake kindness and this, like, politeness.
Mm-hmm.
But you always feel the daggers. Mm-hmm. Like, you know when a British person don't like you, because they will ice you out.
Right.
And they don't even say nothing.
Mm.
And I think for me, that's just, I'm just like, what are they? What, what's
with,
going on?
You know, at least with the Karens, they're going to be like, you're not supposed to be here.
Right. They're going
to
be like,
oh, okay, yeah. So this woman's about to pop off.
Like, she's honest about it.
Right. Yeah. So I can mentally prepare for that.
Right. Yeah. Whereas, you know, people here be like, you sure you want that? Honey, I'm trying to go catch a train. Can you give me my stuff so I can go? Like, why are you questioning me and staring at me? Mm. Like, the line's long. Mm. It's wild how passive it is over here. Yeah. And it's also, like, one of those things where having conversations with the same individuals about, like, confrontation.
Yeah.
And how they handle it. And it's, like, not a lot of times they're not confrontational individuals. That's not everyone in the UK, of course. But, like, when you do get a bit, I don't want to say rowdy, I don't know what the right word is, but when you're being more assertive, right, and you're holding your ground and placing yourself, like, that does not mean Renisha is shouting. Renisha is like this loud, angry individual, right? It means talk to me like you have respect. I'll talk to you like you have respect. Mm-hmm. But also give him my stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, let's be civil about this, you know. And it's just it's a wild thing to think about when it comes to talking to individuals around here. It's like you gotta, what is it, sweeten your conversations with, not to hurt their feelings. Mm-hmm. But it's like, why? You should know that you're hurting me. Mm-hmm. You should know what you're saying, what your actions are doing are affecting me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you don't care should be a problem. You mm-hmm. should start caring. Because a lot of the things that you do enjoy, like we've said, that comes from the beauty industry, the tech industry. A lot of things that you enjoy, my people made that.
Yeah.
Your people made that.
Yeah.
Your people made that. Mm-hmm. Start respecting me and my people. Like, we need the respect. You know what I'm saying?
Acknowledge it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild.
I love that. And I think one thing, I guess, to pose a question to all of you, including myself, but... I think being a migrant and being labeled as, like, an outsider does kind of warp, or could it, sorry, does being a migrant or labeled as an outsider warp your own perception of yourself? Because I think, Renisha, you kind of hit on this a little bit when you mm-hmm. talked about, like, if you do act assertive, now that you're the angry Black woman.
Yeah.
Right? Now you're pushed into that idea where you second guess yourself and your own behavior, and you're like, damn, am I this?
Yeah. You say that and I'm like thinking to myself, you know, first time coming over here, I was like, okay, maybe I don't want to take a lot of, like, American mindsets and bring it to, like, the British culture. But then I start listening to, like, other podcasts, individual Black women, or just listening to them on the TV, and they say the similar things or similar mm-hmm. words are getting described to them in a negative way. I'm like, oh, okay, so I am feeling what I'm feeling, and it's very much valid. So I do start to label myself as an outsider. I mean, I already did so because, again, I'm a Black American mm-hmm. in a British world. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that is going to be, like, a culture shock to me. But when it comes to, like, my identity and the way people are perceiving me, yeah, I'm always gonna label myself as an outsider.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mom?
Do you know what's weird? I think because I grew up until I was, like, maybe 19, 20 years old, without wearing hijab, and with people, like, never knowing exactly where I'm from, like, just that, like, quirky ethnic girl, I don't really know exactly what she is. I always felt like a part of British society. I was always like, yeah, I'm British. Like, I claim that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started wearing hijab, I think that's when I started realizing, like, wait, no, I'm not British because I can't be British. You know, like, I don't know what British actually means, or like what British values actually are. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, I have a passport, but what does that show for me? And I think for me, like, I've never been made to feel othered, but of course my community has.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, being a part of that, like, I know that I'm never going to be accepted as British, but I don't want to be accepted as British because I don't want to be connected to this country in that way, you know? Like, I want to claim that, yeah, I am British, but I am a British Muslim Pakistani woman, and that's what I make it, you know? Like, British is personal to me because it takes account for everything that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I want to reclaim that, you know? And I reclaim that through being here and
advocating in the communities that I do, and my family being here, and them feeling like they are rooted here, and creating those roots for myself, like not just feeling that, yeah, I'm an immigrant who moved here, but that this is my home. And I think that's really difficult to do, you know, when you don't have any, I don't have any roots attached to this country. Like, I don't know what its culture is, if it even has a culture. But it's about like having that individual connection and doing that through like the people that I get to know here and the relationships that I build here that makes me feel like this is home. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really, powerful. Because you are redefining what it means to be British and highlighting all the communities that are here and as well propping up and helping all those communities. And I think that's what you, I think it sucks. It's on migrants to set the standard for that. So we don't, we aren't considered as like outsiders, or we aren't warping our own perceptions of ourselves to fit some type of like assimilation culture. But I think, like, at the same time, I think that's so powerful to say that even though I don't fully agree or know what it means to be British, I am still British. Because you're creating that space for so many other people that are like you to be able to resonate with that all of a sudden. And I think that's beautiful in itself. And I really, I really vibe with that. And I think I've been a military brat growing up, so that military bright side just means your family's in the military, you move a lot, and I've never fully felt like I had a home somewhere, and I've always felt othered or an outside. But I kind of don't mind that, because those are where I find the best people and the best pockets of people, and then that's honestly where I find myself, kind of similar to you, where before I'd be like, oh, don't call me an American, whatever. But now being outside of America, and I'm like, you know what? We are diverse. You know what? Being American doesn't just mean being white American, being a Karen. It means so much more than that. It means having a country that does have a melting pot of cultures, that does, even though shit politics, does have some really good politics. And I don't think I fully recognized that until I got the job here. And everybody's referencing these things, like community lawyering, and they're like, oh yeah, this was created in the U.S. Oh, this was created in the U.S. So I'm thinking, where the fuck was I? Okay.
Since when?
Since when? I was like, we're doing these things? Right. Why am I not hearing about that?
Yeah.
And again, that's I think what I needed to redefine what I thought American meant. And to be able to also, like you say, well, I'm not just American. I am Latin American. I am Mexican American. I'm El Salvadorian American. And connecting all those things to recognize that that is solely me. And that I'm not the only one that's like that. There's a whole group of us. Like, and I think that's beautiful. But to end it on a little bit of a spicy note. All right, y'all. It's time. What are some things you wish you could tell white people about? Or even just say to a white person.
Just stop.
I like it. Just stop. Stop everything you're doing.
But for real though, I think I have two things.
Yes.
And I've written them down. So one is that we're talking about this, right? Like, their solidarity. Without action and advocacy actually promotes structures of ignorance, racism, and xenophobia. And it's either through their fear and silence or through their, like, you know, that passive care and sympathy? That means nothing. They're just doing it to, like, satisfy their own white guilt. That not only welcomes, but enhances these same structures. And like, this creates that kind of ignorance we were talking about, like the willful ignorance that then builds on the normalization that one group of people, whether it be immigrants, black or brown people, exist to be constantly targeted. And it grows into this belief that they deserve the crimes they're being subject to. because they're not white. And most of all, is these communities deserve to be persecuted or at the most extreme destroyed because they are challenging white people and they are also threatening the lives of white people. You know, when it's their own, that's when they are most concerned.
Yeah.
And case in point is Palestine and Israel right now, right? Like, we talked about this. We've seen this in the law, the media, the international community, in the people we thought were allies as well. Mm-hmm. But compare this and compare the genocide in Congo and Sudan and in Tigray, Ethiopia, and the Uyghur Muslims in China or the Kashmiri Muslims in Indian-occupied Kashmir. Compare that complete disregard for the genocides to Ukraine.
Mm. Mm.
And, you know, this is not an oppression Olympics, but comparisons have to be made when there is, like, a systemic difference in treatment of people because one is white and the other is not.
Mm-hmm.
And one is serving Western interests and the other is not. That's my first point. The second is for white people as individuals to understand and internalize that these structures are largely able to exist and thrive because of their silence and in spite of our constant cries for change. And if you, and I'm talking to the white people listening, want to spread love and not hate, then know that your love without justice is completely hollow. We do not want that. And it is not your passive care, but or you telling me, I'm so sorry this is happening, the world is a scary place.
Yeah.
It's actually your awareness that you are not centering yourself, but you are outraged for us and with us, and you're acting in that outrage to amplify our voices and our life and removing yourself from the narrative. That's it.
Period. What she said.
100% not following up. Period.
Okay, and if you need to rewind, we can set this for a double. Because
just hit this three times. Because
everything you said, exactly. Everything you said. And I love that you said, the love is just hollow if there's no justice behind it. Because don't even give it to me. Mm-hmm. Don't even waste your time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be like, peace, love. Mm. No, you don't. You don't know me.
And okay. It's obvious you don't want change.
Mm.
Where can people find you if they want to follow? Follow you in your journey.
I'm on Twitter and I'm on LinkedIn. You got the links. Just tap it and I'm there.
She said go ahead and click it.
Right.
So I can tell you more about yourself. And then go ahead and follow up on those actions, please.
Right. She said I'll give you a list. Some must-to-dos.
Perfect.